Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, at the 12th Hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is January 15, 2017. It is Shabbat 18, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled Faith is a Victory. Then chant along the hills of life, ye Christian soldiers, rise, and press the battle ere the night shall end the glowing sky. Against the foe and veils below, let all our strength be held. It is the victory we know that overcomes the world. Faith is a victory. Faith is a victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. His banner over us is love, our sword, the word of Yah. We tread the road, the saints above, we shout of triumph far. Our faith, they like a whirlwind's breath, swept on for every field. The faith of it, they conquered death, is still a shining shield. Faith is a victory. Faith is a victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. On every hand a foe we find, drawn up in red array. The tents of ease be left behind, and onward to the fray. Salvation's helmet on his head, the truth all girded about. The earth shall tremble neath the tread, and echo with the shout. It's a victory. Faith is a victory. Oh, glorious victory. Victory that overcomes the world. To him that overcomes the foe, what raiment shall be given? Before the angels he shall know his name confessed in heaven. Then onward from the hills of light, our hearts with love aflame, we'll vanquish all the host of night in Yahshua's conquering name. Faith is a victory. Faith is a victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. The woman of Revelation 12, that's the name of our sermon today. We're going to start with verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. Now I'm reading from Pound of Greetings, Volume 1 of V.T. Hall's number 21. I'm on page 13. And this is a text of address that he gave back there in December 28, 1946. Matter of fact, I'm going to start all over with that address from page 1 of it, because it's talking about the kingdom of Yahweh here in Matthew 13, which we need to review anyway.
And so I'm going to start with page one of that. It says, no matter how great and how effective a revival reformation, even Yahweh himself may launch in his congregation, for the scriptures make it plain that both the sinners and the saints will be in the congregation of the Seventh-day Adventists until the harvest of the 144,000. No one needs to brag that the members of his congregation are all saints, that they are all of one accord. If they really are of one accord, then it must be that they are all terrorists, that there is no saint among them, that the congregation of the Seventh-day Adventists for a certainty is not the congregation of which Yahshua speaks in his word. If anything is plain in the Bible, this one thing is. Now let us turn unto the 13th chapter of the Matthew. Now folks that are hearing this sermon, you can take this sermon, Jeff White and different ones, and take this to your brethren in the Adventist church and tell them this. Matthew 13:24-25. And another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. The reason given for the tares to be among the wheat is that men slept. Plainly then, if man had kept awake, the enemy would not have sown the tares. Now, to ascertain what it means for men to be awake, we shall read from the third chapter of Matthew. Now, I want to make a comment here. And I'm going to reread that in Matthew 13:24-25. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man. This is the prophet for the Seventh-day Adventist church, which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, now the prophet sowed the good seed, but these men are the ministers that are underneath the prophet. The prophet in this case is Ellen G. White in 1844. In 1930, it was V.T. Hart that sowed the good seed in the field, the shepherd rod, for the Seventh-day Adventist church. In 1970, Brother Johnson was the prophet that sowed the good seed in the field at Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas. Alright. But while men slept, while the leaders of the Seventh-day Adventist church, the ministers slept, well, if you're sleeping, you don't know what's going on around you. Alright, now watch this. But while men slept, his enemy came. Okay. Now, who was the enemy to the Seventh-day Adventist ministers? The Jesuits, infiltrators of the Seventh-day Adventist Church from the General Conference headquarters. General Conference let them come in and join and commission them to be leaders of this at the conference level, over the ministers and at the church level. So, while the ministers slept, the General Conference sent their Jesuit officers down there that was over these ministers, and they told them what to teach and what the truth was about their doctrine. They told them how to teach their doctrine, in other words. So they watered down their doctrine, the Adventist ministers. The Jesuit leaders in the church watered down their doctrine and forced them to teach it the way they watered it down. So while man slept, while the Seventh-day Adventist minister slept, his enemy, the Jesuits, came and sowed tares among the wheat. Okay, among the wheat. Now, who are the wheat? The wheat is a grain that represents the harvest. So when it comes harvest time, you harvest the wheat and you separate it from the tares. The wheat is your remnant. So now the harvest of the first fruits harvest brings forth a remnant of new leaders. the 144,000. They're all leaders. They're not laity. They're leaders. They're the ones that Yahweh has preordained from the foundation of the world, that are anointed with His Spirit and with the truth, and they're pure and undefiled. It says so in Revelation 14, 1-5. So they're not defiled with women. False doctrine of false churches. They're not defiled with that false doctrine that those Jesuits forced the Adventist ministers to teach. While men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. Well, the reason given for the tares to be among the wheat is that men slept. Seventh-day Adventist ministers went to sleep. What lulled them to sleep? They were given a hypo from a needle. Satan gave them a hypo. Okay, and he put them to sleep. In other words, he had them ordained as ministers. He gave them a license to preach, which is illegal. He gave them a license to preach because they finished a course of curriculum at a college somewhere, and they got a certificate that said that they were qualified preachers now. They graduated, in other words. So it says, these are the men. And so when they got assigned to their churches to be a minister over a certain church, the tithes and offerings paid their salary. So they said, oh wow, I've got it made now. I've got a built-in audience. I've got a built-in salary. All I got to do is preach what they tell me to preach. And don't put my own interpretation on any doctrine, and I can continue feeding out of the feed bag and have me a living that constitutes Adventist ministers going to sleep at the wheel. Alright. Well, the reason given for the tares to be among the wheat, and when I say wheat, I'm going to say the reason for the tares being among the 144,000 is that the ministers went to sleep. Plainly then, the ministers had kept awake, the enemy, the Jesuits, would not have been allowed to come into their congregation and sow the tares. Now, to ascertain what it means for men to be awake, we shall read from the 3rd chapter of Matthew, verse 5 and 6. Then went out to him to Jerusalem and all Judea and all the region round about Jordan, and were baptized of him, that is John the Baptist, in the Jordan, confessing their sin. For this scripture makes plain that John the Baptist baptized many, and that those whom he baptized were only those who confessed their sins. Matthew 3, 7 and 8. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees come unto his baptism, he said unto them, O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bring forth therefore fruits meet for repentance. Now, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were a type of the General Conference President and his officers of Jesuits that are in charge of the temple. Okay? So, there you have it. It says, though these were the popular groups of the John's day, he not only refused to baptize them, but also plainly and politely gave them to understand that baptism is not something with which to cover sin, but something with which to wash them away. He made it clear that he was not in the business of making hypocrites. John left no doubt in their minds that Elohim did not have need of them, but that they had need of him. For the Pharisees and the Sadducees then went away with the full knowledge that the great wide awake preacher of the day, John the Baptist, was not taken up with their popularity, much less with their pedigree. In view of the John's firmness of the purpose and the fact that the Yahweh said no greater prophet than he hath ever arisen, we know that John was wide awake, and so all preachers should be. We as members of the church, too, should be awake as was John, and as firm as was Job able to say, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Job 13:15, Matthew 22:9-12. Go ye therefore into the highways, and as many as ye shall find, bid unto the marriage. So, these servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found, both bad and good, and the wedding was furnished with the guests. Now it says, both bad and good. And when the king came in to see the guest, he saw there a man which had not on a wedding garment. So that man that had not on a wedding garment, he was one of those that was invited to the wedding feast. And so in that case, you could say that they did invite the good and the bad, and this one bad dude, he accepted the invitation and came. And he saith unto him, Friend, how camest thou in hither, not having a wedding garment? Now notice Yahshua is the bridegroom. He's the master of ceremony of this wedding feast. And he's identifying this here, this bad dude as a friend. Now, who was this bad dude in this parable? It was Judas Iscariot. Remember? Yahshua asked him at the Last Supper. He says, I've identified you as having, you're unclean. I know your heart. I know what's in your heart. You're unclean. I know your motives. I know what you're planning on doing. I know what you've already done. You are an enemy that came in. And who were the men that was asleep when the enemy came in? The 11 disciples. They were his chosen. They were Yahshua's chosen ministers of the day. Yet they were asleep at the wheel. Otherwise, Judas Iscariot would have never got in and joined them. Okay, now, that's another story. So he says, Friend, Judas, how camest thou in hither not having a wedding garment? Now, you know what the wedding garment is. It's that ordained system of true worship found in the temple. And it is from that temple in heaven. It says so in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 through 5. Be ye clothed upon with this house from heaven. That's your wedding garment. So he says to Judas, how come you don't have the wedding garment on? And having a wedding garment, and he was speechless. Now this parable applies to all of these ordained ministers. Prophets that have taken on and put on the wedding garment at one time, they knew what the wedding garment was. They had put it on at one time. Willis Johnson knew what it was. He had put it on in 1970. He clothed himself with that house from heaven in 1970. He taught it to us. He taught us how to be clothed upon that house from heaven. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 through 5. But what happened was, over the course of time, those garments became stained. And they got replaced with some filthy garments because of the hypocrisy of the leader and the members that followed him. drifting into idolatry, not realizing, slowly drifting into idolatry, starting with the birthday celebration. All right? It says, though Elohim's servants be awake and do their work right, yet some of the members may fail to put on the wedding garment. Okay. Brother Jonathan found the wedding garment. He introduced it to Gilead Center in 1970 through creation calendar, restoring all the feast days, all the ordained system of true worship, the daily and the whole nine yards, the 9 and 3 o'clock daily worship service, restored all that, restored the health laws, restored the sacred name, restored all the additional feast days that goes with the seventh-day Sabbath, in Leviticus 23, put Yahweh people back on true time of the creation calendar, had true worship, and yet he adulterated it. He adulterated it all by his apostatizing back into idolatry that he was called out of in 1970. Okay? For a garment, is something to put on the outside of the body. The garment, therefore, denotes a daily Messiah-like deportment as the righteousness of the Messiah and the one's daily life. For the fact that the man in the parable was speechless when asked, "Friend, how camest thou in hither not having a wedding garment?" shows that he was guilty of neglect, not of ignorance. He was without excuse, and he knew it. Let us go back to Matthew 25:1-5. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil and their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. Again, it plainly appears that the church membership is divided into 2 classes, the wise and the foolish. The wise take no chances. They continually search for oil, truth, that is, and they fill their vessel with it at the first opportunity. For the foolish, though, see no need for any more than what is in their lamps. They are satisfied with what they already have. For the oil, a substance which lightens heads one's path, obviously is figurative of the prophetic truth. Truth that lightens the heart by the unveiling of the future. Concretely speaking, the lamp filled with the oil denotes the individual's reservoir of the truth in action. Truth that meets its needs only for the time then present. The extra oil in the vessel, therefore, represents additional truth. Truth that takes up where the old truth leaves off. In other words, the oil and the lamps and the oil and the vessels represent 2 revealed truths at 2 different times. One following the other. For example, while the judgment for the dead is truth in the action, the judgment for truth for the living is the truth to go into the action as soon as the judgment for the dead is over. Obviously, oil that has been consumed, as is the oil and the virgin's lamps, represents past truth, truth that has accomplished its purpose, but the oil and the vessel represents truth ready to be activated and made to shine immediately after the oil and the lamps is consumed. Since the 10 virgins represents the church membership during the judgment for the dead, the oil and the lamps manifestly represents the truth of the judgment for the dead. The extra oil that is in the vessels must therefore represent the truth of the judgment for the living. For the additional truth, early writings 277, plainly then the lamps gone empty represents the judgment for the dead passing away, and the oil in the vessels represents the truth of the judgment for the living going into action. Since all 10 had oil in their lamps, but only half of them had the oil in their vessels, the symbolism clearly discloses that, as always, the whole congregation membership did not accept the message of the judgment for the living. Okay, so it says the whole church membership did not accept the message of the judgment for the living. Now, the judgment of the living opened up in 2002 at Kermit, Texas, at the headwaters for the Seventh-day Adventist Church at Gilead Center, with the prophet Vernon W. Johnson at the helm. And the message of the judgment for the living was presented unto him. And he, along with the whole congregation, rejected it. This brings a fulfillment of what V.T. Hall said about the Seventh-day Adventist Church in 1930. They had completely rejected the judgment for the living that he was teaching. He was teaching the judgment for the living. Even though it wasn't time for the judgment for the living, but the judgment for the living, for the message was given first in 1930 by V.T. Hall. Okay? So he says, the foolish virgins were satisfied with the truth they had acquired while joining the church that bore the message of the judgment for the dead, but failed to acquaint themselves with the additional message, the message of the judgment for the living. Well, Verlis Johnson, believing that V.T. Hallef was teaching the judgment for the living, and Verlis Johnson said that V.T. Hallef, though it was 40 years premature, that the judgment for the living began with him in 1970 at Kermit, Texas, at Gilead Center. And so that's what Verlis Johnson taught. He said, we are in the judgment of the living. So, but we were not in the judgment of the living, but Verlis Johnson was teaching what V.T. Hallef was teaching in 1930. So Verlis Johnson is telling Adventists again in 1970 that we are in the judgment of the living. Well, in one way, we were in the judgment of the living. But we were still in the time of the sixth seal, which is only for the judgment of the dead period. But the seventh seal overlaps the sixth seal. In other words, you start teaching the latter rain of truth, which is for the judgment for the living. You start teaching that, oh my goodness, you start teaching that 40 years before, 73 years before it opens up. That's what Verlis Johnson did. In 1970, he taught the judgment of the living for 33 years. V.T. Hallef taught it for 40, the Rod taught it for 40 years. And Verlis Johnson taught it for 33 years. And then it finally came to pass in 2002, 2003, that the judgment of the living opened up with the beginning of the 12th hour and the closing out of the 11th hour. V.T. Hallef taught the judgment of the living in 1930 in the 10th hour. Verlis Johnson taught the judgment of the living in 1970 in the 11th hour. But the judgment of the living wasn't scheduled to go into operation until the beginning of the 12th hour. And the beginning of the 12th hour started in 2002 at Kermit, Texas. And so the judgment of the living was given to Elijah David to teach it in its present tense, that it had opened up and Ezekiel 9 had kicked in for the church of the marking and the slaying, starting in the city in the Adventist church. It started at Kermit, Texas. It started with the ancient men for the house. It started with Verlis Johnson in 2002 at Kermit, Texas, and went back down through the city, the Adventist church. And it's been ongoing ever since. But it is just about to culminate with the bringing forth of 144,000 out of the Adventist church. All right. Finally, after the necessity for it became imperative, they began to search for it, but it did them no good. Just talking about that extra oil. They were too late getting it. When they finally realized that that extra oil had been taught to them for the last 80, 90 years, when they realized that it had been taught in the form of Yahweh raising up new prophets, one to succeed the other, it had been passed along, that extra oil had been passed along from one to the other. That extra oil actually is the teaching of the latter rain of truth with the judgment of the living in it. These were left out with the tares only because they let the devil sow in their hearts seeds of foolishness. In other words, idolatry. Seeds of contentment, lukewarmness, with the initial truth by which they joined the church. Thus, they mistakenly felt no need of additional light from the Yahweh. But when prophecy began to fulfill itself beyond their scope of the divinely revealed knowledge, and as they saw the events of the gospel shaping themselves contrary unto their expectation, they became alarmed and confused, saw themselves in the darkness, for the lesson is unmistakable. Those who forever feel rich and increased with goods and in need of nothing more, will not get to the door on the time. Besides the tares among the wheat, they are idlers, inactive folks who are to be cast out and destroyed with the tares. Let us read now Matthew 25:14-30. Matthew 25:14-30. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1, and to every man according unto his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them other 5 talents. And likewise he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid the Yahweh's money. After a long time the Yahweh of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received the 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Yahweh, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His master said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy master. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Master, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His master said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy master. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Master, I know thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His master answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed, and thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchanges. And then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and a gnashing of teeth. From this parable is seen that when a Christian falls asleep, Satan comes along and sows seed of idleness in his heart, so as to cause him to be cast out with the tares. At the commencement of the harvest, therefore, this class of tares is the first to appear as such. It is high time to learn that religion is not an opiate. There is still another class of church members who, in a different way, fall victims with the tares. Thus we shall see from Matthew 25:31-46. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For For I was an hungry, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Master, when saw we thee an hungry, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. Then shall I say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angel. For I was an hunger, and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Master, when saw we thee an hungered, or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say as unto you, inasmuch as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not unto me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. The most outstanding sin of the goat class of the professed believers is that they are all for self and none for others. The sheep class are the opposite in character, since those who do charity work are not to make a display of it, not to let the left hand know what the right hand is doing, Matthew 6:3, and since the system of such benevolent work is clearly pointed out in the Hebrew economy, we would do well to look there for it. To promise the assembling of the people for the religious service as well as to provide for the poor, the second tithe of all the increase, was required concerning the first tithe. The Master, the Yahshua, had declared, I have given the children of the Levi all the tenth in Israel. But in regard unto the second, he commanded, Thou shalt eat before the Yahweh the Elohim in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of thy corn, and of thy wine, and of thine oil, and the firstlings of thy herds, and of thy flocks, that thou mayest learn the fear of the Yahweh the Elohim always. Thus tithe, or its equivalent in money, they were for 2 years to bring to the place where the sanctuary was established. After presenting a thank offering unto Elohim and a specified portion to the priest, the offerers were to use the remainder for a religious feast, in which the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow should participate. Thus provision was made for the thank offerings and the feast at the yearly festival, and the people were drawn to the society of the priests and Levites, that they might receive instruction and encouragement in the service of the Yahweh. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 530. For this work to be carried out systematically by the Yahweh's treasury through gifts and free will offerings, sometimes called second tithe, we cannot do. But do likewise if we are to find favor with the Yahweh. Now back to Matthew 13:44. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. Matthew 13:45-46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man seeking goodly pearl, who, when he had found one pearl of a great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. These parables distinctly point out that those who do not care to invest everything they possess, if need be, to obtain the kingdom are to be cast out with the tares. Matthew 13:47-48. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to shore and sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but cast the bad away. A net cast into the sea naturally catches good and bad, the small and large fish, but fish, like all other living creatures, move in families, each species with its kind, and so each time the net is cast, it catches families of fish. So it is that the gospel net, in many instances, naturally brings in the families and relatives all in one catch. That is, as parents accept the gospel of the Yeshua, along with them are also brought the children and even relatives and friends. The bad fish represents those who, with no real knowledge, conviction, and conversion of their own, but through emotion and the influence of others, join the church. So it is that those who never studiously, wholeheartedly, and zealously take hold of the principles of Yeshua are cast out. They are to perish with the tares. All who are too lazy to study and who give the devil a chance to sow devilish seed in their hearts, making them believe that the preacher or the minister will take them through the pearly gates, having no experience of their own, are cheated of eternal life. They instead get eternal death. True enough, the Spirit of Yahweh causes people to become one thing, and the Spirit of Satan causes them to become another thing, but the difference is discernible only as the harvest time approaches, when the truth of the harvest is revealed. From these simple parables comes the fact that Satan raises tares in the church and ever tries his level best to keep them in it. Why? Let us find the answer in Revelation 12. Revelation 12:13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. When the devil saw that he was no longer permitted entrance into heaven, he went to persecute the church after she brought forth the man-child, Yeshua. For the dragon, therefore, is to persecute the church in her Christian period. Well, when we say Christian period here, I'm going to change this Christian period to the branch period, so we can know precisely, because the Christian period, according to the Christian world, it started after the Catholic Church 1260-year period was over in 1798 A.D., and then we entered into the Christian era, when the Protestants had their way and brought Reformation, starting in 1500 with Martin Luther. That was called the Christians protesting against the Catholics. Okay? So now when we read about when the devil saw that he was no longer permitted entrance into heaven, he went to persecute the apostolic congregation of the Church of the Nazarenes with the apostles, the disciples, as the organizers and the head of the apostolic kingdom. The apostolic kingdom of heaven, headed up by the 12 apostles, so Paul being the 12th one, ended up being the 12th one, okay, after she brought forth the man-child, Yeshua, the dragon, therefore, is to persecute the antitypical apostolic congregation representing the kingdom of David here on earth, here in the 12th parabolic hour that we're in now, in her branch period. So we're in the branch period. We have entered into the branch period since 2002 of the kingdom. Now this is new life, folks. The kingdom of heaven on earth was set up with the Seventh-day Adventist Church in 1844. The kingdom was organized in 1844. The kingdom of heaven. Ellen G. White was the first leader of the kingdom of heaven here on earth. 1844. She inspired a person, a prophetess. She was given the candlestick to preside over the candlestick of Laodicea, Revelation 3:14-17. She was in charge of that candlestick. That candlestick represents the sanctuary service of the kingdom of heaven here on earth. Okay. Now it says, and when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, it says unto the earth. Now if you go read Revelation, I believe 12:9. Let's see. It says he is cast. No, it says into the earth and onto the earth. Now, there's a little bit of a difference there. Onto the earth. Well, let's see. And, it'd be Revelation 12:9. It says that, and the dragon, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth. Into the earth. Now, went into means he went inside the earth. Now, Satan's home is inside the earth. It's inside that inner planet of the earth. Okay, he says, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our Elohim and the power of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before Yahweh, before our Elohim day and night. So it says, therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe be to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea. For the devil has come down unto you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, this is verse 13, U-N-T-O, unto the earth. See, in verse 9, he was cast into the earth, and now he's cast unto the earth. And actually, it should, that unto should be into. In other words, unto means that he was cast from heaven and he came to this place. Unto this place, and he now lives on top of it and inside of it. His home is inside of the earth. Okay? Which was called the hollow earth, he lives inside the earth. Okay, now, as we continue, it says, Revelation 12:14, and unto the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. Because of the persecution, the church was given the means by which to take her flight from the promised land, the vineyard, into the land of the Gentiles, the wilderness. Now you get this? Because of the persecution of the apostolic congregation of the Church of the Nazarene, of the, made up of the 12 apostles, was given the means by which to take her flight from the promised land. Yes, and it says, parentheses, the vineyard. The promised land is the vineyard. Into the land of the Gentiles, the wilderness. So anything outside the boundaries of Israel, the parameters of Israel, is considered the wilderness in the world. It's in the land of the Gentiles. Gentile means the collection of all the different races, and people all over the world. That's your Gentile population. Revelation 12:15, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. At the beginning, the serpent persecuted the church, but as he saw that the church still grew and prospered, he reversed his tactics and began instead to persecute the pagans who would not join the church, and raised ministers by whom to bring in a flood of the unconverted, by which to paganize the church so that she could not Christianize them. Revelation 12:16, and the church helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Thus is the church purified, and thus are the tares destroyed. As tares they are burned, as unprofitable workers they are cast into outer darkness, there to weep and gnash their teeth. As unfit guests for the wedding, they are bound hand and foot and cast out into outer darkness. As foolish virgins, they are refused entrance. As goats, they are sent into everlasting punishment. As dragons flood, they are swallowed by the earth. But the actual thing that happens to them all in common is fully described in Ezekiel's prophecy, chapter 9. Let us turn to it. Ezekiel 9:1-11. He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near it, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men come from the way of the higher gate which lies toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen with a writer's inkhorn by his side, and they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the Yahweh of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was to the threshold of the house, and he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side, and the Yahweh said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abomination that be done in the midst. So, this says that thereof. Now, this man clothed in linen, this is none other but the Yahshua, the high priest. He's the man with the writer's inkhorn by his side. Now, in the heavenly sanctuary above, the high priest in the first apartment, when he gets through making a remission for the sins of people here on earth by his own blood of sprinkling, it says so right there in 1 Peter 1:2, and it says also there in Hebrews 12, I believe about 23, through the blood of sprinkling it talks about. He's our high priest. He has the blood of sprinkling that he applies unto the sinner's record whenever a sinner comes and repents on a daily basis. And so there he applies it to their record. And he is the man in linen, because as soon as he applies it, there's a record made of it. Now, whether it be Yahshua that's got a writer's inkhorn, or whether it's one of these angels. Now, it talks like there in Ezekiel 9 that it's six men come from the way of the higher gate. It says six men. One was clothed in linen. One had a writer's inkhorn by his side with a pen in hand. And he did some writing and making some records. Okay, he may very well have been the lead angel, the leading angel of that group, of the five. But Yahshua is depicted as a high priest in the heavenly sanctuary that's dressed in white linen. And white linen is also the garment that is given unto the saints. All right. And unto the others, let's continue. He said in my hearing, go ye after him through the city, and smite. Let not your eyes spare, neither have your pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is a mark, and begin at my sanctuary. Then they began at the ancient men which were before the house. Now these ancient men before the house, we know applies to some distinct people. They have identity, which we understand today would be the angel of the candlestick, Brother W. Johnson, put in charge of the sanctuary for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because he's the one that restored it in 1970 to the Adventist Church, Brother W. Johnson. So he's the first one. He's the first man before the house. But it says men here, ancient men. It didn't say ancient man. It said ancient men. There's more than one man here. One man that is judged as the leader of the house of Yahweh. And that would have to be those that were present at the time that judgment came to the house of Yahweh at Kermit, Texas, Gilead Center. And it came, and I was right there with it. Matter of fact, I was in on the judgment. I was one of those being judged, but I came through the judgment. And Alan DeLong, another one that I had brought into the church back in 1981, he came to the church through the judgment there in 2002. And my wife came through the judgment. You know, there's only three of us came through that judgment, but the rest of them fell. Brother Johnson, the main leader, the number one leader, he fell. And along with all of those, his family and everyone that stayed with him, which were before the house, and he said unto them, defile the house, and fill the courts of the saints. So go ye forth, and they went forth and slew in the city. Now the city is the Seventh-day Adventist Church proper. Okay, so judgment started in 2002 at the headwaters of the Adventist Church at Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas. The third and last feeding pastor for the Seventh-day Adventists since 1844. And that was Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas, out there in the desert, out in the wilderness, where its headquarters were. And it came to pass while they were slaying them, and I was left, that I fell upon my face and cried and said, O Yahweh Elohim, wilt thou destroy all the residue of Israel, and thou pour out of thy fury upon Jerusalem? Then said he unto me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great, and the land is full of blood, and the city full of perverseness. For they say, the Yahweh hath forsaken the earth, and the Yahweh seeth not. And as for me also, mine eyes shall not spare. Neither will I have pity, and I will recompense their way upon their head. And behold, the man clothed with the linen which had the ink on by his side reported the matter, saying, I have done as thou hast commanded me. The promise to purify Jerusalem, Judah, and Israel stands as sure as any promise in the word. For the terms Jerusalem, Judah, Israel, you know, cannot be applied unto anything but to the congregation, the place where everyone should sigh and cry against the abomination. Those who do not sigh and cry are to be left without the mark, and then the angels who have charge of the church smite every one of them, old and young, both maids and little children and women. Only those who have the mark shall be left. They are the remnant. The angels are thus to take care of both the wheat and the tares. Yes, there is to be a clean riddance of every sort of terror, just as anciently there was a clean riddance of all the firstborn in the households that failed to paint the doorposts with the sacrificial blood on the evening of the Passover in the land of Egypt. So shall it be at the commencement of the harvest and the purification of the church. The angels shall smite everyone who forces the abominations in the midst thereof. When is this thorough purging to take place? For the answer, let us turn to Zephaniah chapter 1. This also brings us to the end of our study for this hour. You can contact us at the 11th hour call. And I'm going to close this service now with a song that I have written entitled, A Friend in Yahshua. I have a friend in Yahshua. He's all the world to me.
Then they'll all look up and see.